This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, American Indian and Alaskan Native women are more likely to experience a physical assault compared to women of other races. While many are striving to end the violence, Sarah Deer is working with tribal nations to address the high rate of violence and protect victims. She was a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Deer also recently received the MacArthur Fellowship Program Award, also known as the Genius Award, and she was recently a speaker at UW La Crosse. So, Sarah, I'm wondering if you can just first help us understand, why is it that Native American women may be more likely to experience domestic abuse, sexual violence, other types of violence in their lifetime?
There's no quick and easy answer to that question, but it seems to me, and this is based on the research I've done, that when perpetrators are not held accountable for their behavior, their abusive behavior, their behavior continues, and it sends messages to others in the community. So what we have seen is basically a breakdown of criminal justice for Native women, which sends a message then to both victims and perpetrators that the system is not going to protect the people who are abused.
So let's maybe break down some of those systems that come into play. If a woman is abused on tribal land, her abuser may be tried in a tribal court. Can you explain how tribal courts are set up then?
Well, each tribal court's a little different. And the basic concept is that tribes retain the inherent authority that they've always had. So jurisdiction hasn't been given to us as tribes. We already have it. And so some tribes exercise criminal jurisdiction, meaning that they prosecute and convict. Some tribes limit their hearings to just things involving family law. But some tribes do everything, just like a state. Just like a state court would, they hear family law and property disputes and contracts. And so it depends on the tribe. But those tribes that prosecute, that actually take action in criminal matters, have certain restrictions on what they can and can't do. And some of that explains the high rate of violence because of those restrictions.
So let's talk about those restrictions and maybe historically how they've been set up and how they've played out in some of the tribal courts.
Well, I think probably the most important law that affects Indian tribes today actually comes out of a U.S. Supreme Court case. And a not very long ago Supreme Court case in 1978. And what the Supreme Court ruled is that tribes can't prosecute non-Indians. So if you are not a tribal member and you go onto a reservation and you commit a crime, any crime from burglary to murder, the tribe doesn't have the authority to prosecute you.
But then could the county or the state step in?
Sure. The way the structure is set up is that depending on the tribe, you have shared jurisdiction with either the federal government or the state government. In Wisconsin, it's largely the state government, with the exception of the Menominee Nation, which has a federal structure. So the idea is that if a non-Indian committed a crime against a Native woman on Indian land, the state would come in and prosecute that case. Historically, that hasn't worked well. I think in recent years, and particularly in Wisconsin, we've seen a great improvement in that relationship. But in other states, it hasn't worked as well. And tribes are really suffering because they can't hold people accountable.
And as you said, because of that history of not being able to hold people accountable, the perpetrators, this is one of the reasons that Native American women have experienced more violence?
Absolutely. I think that's a good explanation. It's not the only explanation. But when women report crime and nothing happens, they stop reporting. And nobody can prosecute if they don't know of the crime. So Native women in some places have lost trust in the system and would rather sort of suffer in silence rather than try to engage with the criminal justice system.
Do you ever find that maybe non-Native perpetrators, are they attracted ever to Native women or know that maybe they can get away with things easier on tribal land and so they go there?
There's definitely some evidence of that. There's evidence of targeting Native women. There's also evidence of child predators researching the laws and selecting locations where they know that the system maybe is broken. And we also see this with international drug trafficking rings, particularly down in the Southwest. Several organized crime rings from Mexico have selected Indian reservations for their meth manufacturing and distribution because the law enforcement there is so sparse. So it's not just violence against women. It's a large range of different crimes that are very, very very detrimental to Native people.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, my guest is Sarah Deer. She's a professor at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and an advocate for victims of domestic violence, especially on Native American reservations. You talked a bit about abusers who are non-Native, who hurt Native American women. What about tribal members who are abusers on tribal land?
Native men commit these crimes too. And sometimes I think we lose that a little bit because a lot of our national work has focused on the non-Indian perpetrators for good reason because of the sort of jurisdictional problem. But Native men have committed these crimes, and many of them have not been held accountable by the tribal system, by the state system. And that's another way that women suffer in silence, because the fear you don't turn in your own. Right? Native men are already incarcerated at a very, very high percentage. And so there's some, like I think any marginalized community, some discomfort in perpetuating that. And so when we have that kind of violence happen, there's another sort of silence that comes with it. But what's great about the last few years is Native men have really stepped up. Social media has been a great platform for Native men to say this is not acceptable in our community.
So once an abuser does go through the court system, the tribal court system, can you talk about the, you said there are some limits when it comes to prosecution. What are those limits? And obviously every case is different. What can an abuser see?
The maximum until last year, or a few years ago actually, was a 1-year maximum. For any crime, that includes homicide, sexual abuse, child abuse. The federal government had limited the ability of tribes to incarcerate for more than a year. We were able to see some good news, some success in 2010. We were able to convince Congress that that wasn't long enough for some of these crimes. And so now tribes are able to sentence to up to 3 years per offense for a maximum of 9 years. Now, that's still not equivalent to what a state can do. If you have, say, a child sexual predator, 9 years doesn't seem like enough. But from a tribal perspective, it's an improvement. I mean, at least that child will be safe for 9 years, but he's going to come back.
Do you know why the federal government had such, I guess, differentiating limits on mm-hmm. those sentencing?
Well, the sentencing limitation comes from actually a federal law in 1968. And Congress appeared to be concerned that tribal courts were not fair, that tribal courts violated civil liberties, that tribal courts were not held to the same standard as state courts. And so as part of a package to deal with that, they said no more than 1 year, because the concern about tribal courts not being sophisticated enough to be fair to all the parties.
Wow. And if I'm not mistaken, you were pretty instrumental in helping to change some of these federal rules. Am I correct?
I think, yes, I played a role, but I think more importantly, it was grassroots Native women's activism that changed the law. I researched about it and wrote about it, but the hard work is really done by the Native women who work on this issue every day, and so I was part of that. But identifying and researching the cause of the problem is sort of my contribution, and Congress did step up and listen for the first time in about 100 years.
And did a lot of this stem from the Amnesty International report that you had worked on? And I guess maybe you could tell people a bit about that.
Sure. I had the opportunity to partner with Amnesty International back in, I would say, about 10 years ago, 2005. And for 2 years, we researched and created a report called Maze of Injustice, which was released in spring of 2007. And that report humanized the data that we had. It told the stories of Native women and had pictures of them, right, rather than the data. And Congress noticed. The United States is often held up to be sort of the model of how human rights are to be respected, but we don't often look at ourselves. And so it was one of the first reports that Amnesty did about the United States as a violator of human rights. And the federal government responded, which sort of surprised me.
Sure.
But it really did wake some folks up on the Hill, and conversations started that hadn't started before.
Because one of the statistics that came out of that report that is shocking is that one in three Native women will be sexually assaulted in her lifetime.
Yes. That data comes from federal government statistics, and it's not a fluke. It's aggregate over about a 10-year period.
And I'm assuming those are only reported?
Well, yes, to some extent. There are people who are willing to share that they've experienced it. I think the rate is much higher. I think the rate is probably closer to 50 to 80% based on my research and my travels. And Obama, President Obama, when he signed the law in 2010 to change the sentencing authority, he said the fact that one in three Native women will be raped in her lifetime should shock our nation's conscience. And not only was that the first time I'd ever heard a president say anything about Native women, but he acknowledged the harm that has been done. And symbolically, that was huge.
So the sentencing changes came about, well, sort of spiraled out of that report and then the other work that is being done. Were other policy changes made as a result of that?
Yes. So we have the 2010 law that changed the sentencing, and then the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization, which was a battle. That was a really tough battle, but finally signed into law in March of 2013, allows tribes to prosecute non-Indians for the first time since 1978. It's limited to domestic violence, so things like child abuse are still not covered. But no one thought it could be done, and it happened. So, and I got to be there when the president signed the bill in 2013. Now we're working on the implementation.
I mean, what was that like, just knowing that the federal government, that the president finally had your attention on such a big issue?
It was validating. I think for many Native women who have worked on this issue for decades, it was validating, but at the same time a little frustrating, like, we've been saying these same things for years. But President Obama did make Native issues a primary issue in his platform, and he made good on his word.
So now that non-Native abusers, probably mostly men, can be tried in a tribal court, what sort of difference does that make for victims of domestic violence?
Well, it will make a difference for many, not all, because you still have the issue of people feeling like they're at fault, they're to blame. But for women who are in abusive relationships, or men who are in abusive relationships with non-Indians, there's more options now. And sometimes options for victims are really important, even if you don't go down that road, just that you have the option.
Do you think that it will make a major difference in ending or, you know, trying to cut back on domestic violence within tribal communities?
I do. I think it's too soon to know the extent of the reform and how much it will change, but I don't see it backfiring. I can't figure out a way that it would actually make things worse. So I'm hopeful that in the next few years we'll have some data to bear out the successes of the reform.
And it's interesting, as you said, that this only addresses being able to try non-Native people who have committed domestic violence. And it's just so interesting to me that it's limited at just that, while so many other things could happen.
Well, we started out with a bigger ask, but politically it was really hard to convince some of our legislators that this was truly a problem that needed to be addressed. And so by making the story about abusers who married into the tribe or lived in the tribe or had children that were members of the tribe, that was hard to ignore. And so politically that was salvageable, whereas some of the other pieces we were asking for were not.
I know it all comes down to politics, but in your mind, what is the holdup to expand this to, you know, offer more protections?
I think there's still a lot of myths and stereotypes about Native people. I think a lot of people are afraid of tribal courts because they don't know what they are. They don't know if they're fair. And so the idea that somebody who's not from that community could be held accountable in a courtroom is really uncomfortable to a lot of folks. I think it's just a matter of education and for folks to see that tribal courts are fair and have due process. But there's a lot of mythology about it.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, my guest is Sarah Deer. She's a professor of law at the William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and an advocate for victims of domestic violence on Native American reservations. She is also a member and a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Beyond what's going on in the court system, the tribal court system on reservations, what else are different tribal nations doing to address domestic violence within their community?
It's really exciting to see the different things that are happening out in tribal communities. A lot of awareness, a lot of speak outs, a lot of walks, a lot of really thinking about how we want to be as Native people. So language comes into it, culture comes into it. And for the first time, I think in a long time, Native women really believe that their systems will change and that people will be held accountable. So the energy is very uplifting, even though the topic is really distressing. The energy is very optimistic.
So I'm assuming some of it is stopping that cycle of abuse, but also maybe encouraging women to speak up if they do find themselves to be a victim?
Yes, to
which
say...
Which can't be easy.
It is never easy for any victim, whatever your race is, to come forward because of the shame and the guilt and the kinds of blame that society puts on victims. But Native women are not complacent and passive, despite the stereotypes. And so now that the systems are being reformed, Native women are saying, you don't have to speak out, but if you do, there will be a system in place to help you.
So you were here in La Crosse talking with students and community members on campus. You gave the speech, Decolonizing the Rape Law, a Native Feminist Synthesis of Safety and Sovereignty. And it was interesting because you gave the talk on what has been historically known as Columbus Day. There's obviously this move to have it more known as Indigenous Peoples Day. Just the timing for you, was that kind of interesting?
Yes, it certainly is. I have been doing more of the Indigenous Peoples Day talks in my different travels. But what a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of Columbus bashing and from the tribal communities. Tribal people think, you know, saying Columbus was not a good man. But from a woman's perspective, there is ample evidence from the shipmates themselves that they felt entitled to Native women's bodies. The second journey, there's a journal entry bragging of the kidnapping and rape of a Native woman. So the image of Columbus for Native women is not just sort of the entry point for colonization and destruction of Indian nations, but actually very personal about the violation of our bodies. And so that when you associate that with Columbus, it becomes even more sort of sinister. And that's why I'm so happy that many campuses and local communities are rethinking Columbus Day.
And I'm wondering if you can maybe explain that rethinking of Columbus Day to people who aren't familiar with people and communities who are trying to push this more.
Well, Columbus Day has been celebrated for many years as sort of the discovery of the Americas. And Native people have always pushed back on that, like, how can you discover us if we're already here? And Columbus really introduced a lot of disease, slavery. He took slaves back to Europe. And that part of the story often isn't told. We hear about his bravery, his discovery, but that's really just part of the picture. So rethinking Columbus Day is about acknowledging that painful part of the past and sort of thinking about how we celebrate Native people. We don't have a holiday for Native people. So
it's kind of wild.
Right. And so maybe rethinking Columbus Day and replacing it with something that focuses on the vibrancy and the resilience of Native people. And it's really validating to see that happen.
You say it's validating to have an Indigenous Peoples Day or any other sort of holiday, month, whatever label you want to put on it. I mean, how much of a difference could that make for Native communities throughout this country?
Well, indifference is a huge problem that we experience. And indifference, I think, doesn't come from a lack of compassion, but from just not knowing. I have law students who have lived in this part of the country their entire lives that don't really have any understanding of the history of Native people. And it's not really their fault in the sense that if they're not exposed to it, they can't learn about it. But celebrating our survival, celebrating our resilience, is something that gets attention. And hopefully that will help more people learn about the history of their communities and the tribes that belong to those communities.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, my guest is Sarah Deer. She's a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and an advocate for victims of domestic violence on Native American reservations. She's also a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. You received the MacArthur Fellowship Program Award, better known as the Genius Award, mm-hmm. which seems like an incredibly wonderful accomplishment.
It was very surprising.
Really?
That's sort of how that's their shtick, right? They keep it a secret until the very last minute, and then suddenly your life changes.
You just get the phone call and say, you are a genius, Sarah.
Well, yeah, basically, yes. That's how it goes down. And no forewarning at all. Didn't even know I had been nominated. Didn't even know I was in the running. So your life changes pretty quickly in a span of a couple of minutes. And I'm still sort of coming down from that. And I wasn't allowed to tell anyone for 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
So except my husband. Mm-hmm. And today's my 14th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
So I called him, and he works in the same building. So he came up, and then we said, well, we're not allowed to tell anyone else for 2 weeks. And that was really hard. And so by the time it actually got publicly announced, I was sort of used to the idea. And then I had all of these folks come to my office and the phone calls and the emails. And it was just overwhelming and still is to some extent overwhelming to think that my work has made that kind of difference to get that kind of recognition.
And you're one of 21 fellows across the nation who received this award. Can you explain to people who may not be familiar with the Genius Award what it is and maybe why people like yourself are selected for it?
Well, in short, it's $625,000 with no strings attached. That's it in a nutshell. But they recognize folks from all different fields. So you have anywhere from choreographers to physicists to law professors. Any field is open. And the MacArthur Foundation researches top people in various fields and selects some folks to both reward what they've done in the past and invest to what they might do in the future. So it really is sort of a validation, but also there's some pressure on me now. Like, I have to be a genius now that I have this award. But the entire experience of learning of it and then the accolades that come from friends and family has been, I think, more important than the money.
Well, obviously they selected you as an individual, but a lot of it is a reflection on the work that you've done towards working with victims of violence, especially within the Native American community.
Yes. So there's the piece where, wow, I'm being validated and rewarded, but there's also the piece about all of the Native women, thousands, that have been doing this work. Who all should be rewarded with this kind of grant. So my goal with this grant is to sort of elevate voices of Native women that haven't been heard. And that might come through, you know, co-authoring a book or creating a film. But I have really all the options I want because there's no strings attached to this money, no reporting, no promises. So I really want to listen to Native women. I really want to hear their stories. And I want other people to hear them as well.
And so with that, and for more people to hear Native women's stories, what can come about from something like that?
Again, just breaking that stereotype, breaking that sort of indifference that comes from ignorance, that Native women are here, that we are here to stay, that we have survived, and we are not passive. We have much to offer the world. So listen to our voices and learn and celebrate, because so often the news is bleak. We have the highest poverty rate, the highest violence rate, and so people often think of Indians as being poor and marginalized, but we're much more than that.
Sarah Deer is a law professor at William Mitchell College in St. Paul and is an advocate for Native American women who are victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. She recently spoke on the UW-La Crosse campus. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.